I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. If you're thinking about it, chances are we're talking about it on WHYY's Radio Times.
Support for NPR podcasts comes from Vanguard, offering investments designed to help individuals and institutions reach their long-term financial goals. 1-888-VANGUARD.
Marty Moss-Cohen. Today on Radio Times, a quick update on the latest tech trends that are revolutionizing both home entertainment and portable media market. This will be an abbreviated show because at 11:20 we'll begin live coverage of President Bush's speech before the United Nations General Assembly. But till then, we want to explore why this holiday retail season we're likely to see some of the huge consumer electronic heavyweights go head-to-head, everything from Microsoft's introduction of its first iPod-like device to the release of the two next-generation video game consoles that could help decide the high-definition DVD format war. To talk about these and any other new developments, we've invited Peter Rojas to join us. He is editor-in-chief of Engadget. That's one of the Internet's most popular consumer electronic weblogs. He's also co-founder of Joystick, a weblog that covers the video game industry, and he appears on Home and Garden's television program, I Want That, Tech Toys. Peter Rojas, welcome back to Radio Times.
Thanks for having me again. I appreciate it.
Peter, last week, Apple rolled out its next generation of iPods, but it also announced that its iTunes website, where you can currently buy a lot of music, has added movies that can be downloaded. And I think Amazon has also done that. How significant is it that these large companies are now getting into the internet movie business?
Well, being able to download movies online is something people have been able to do legally, actually, for a while now, companies like MovieLink and CinemaNow. But what Amazon and Apple are doing is sort of finally bringing it to the masses and making it something that will hopefully be easier for the average person to do. And Apple is one of the first to make it really easy to download a movie and actually transfer it to a portable device.
Right, straight to their iPod device, right?
Yep, exactly.
Now, Apple also announced this gadget. I guess it's not coming out till 2007, but they call it the iTV. What is this going to do?
The iTV is basically what we call like a wireless media adapter, and it lets you stream multimedia content, whether it's photos, video, or audio, from the hard drive on your computer, whether it's a Mac or PC, and watch it or enjoy it on your basically your home entertainment setup. Watch it on your TV or listen to it on your home stereo.
Now, I take it you can only watch stuff that you buy from iTunes, though.
That is not true. You can actually stream any of your collection that is in an unrestricted audio format like MP3 or AAC. So if you rip a CD in iTunes mm-hmm. and have it stored on your computer, you can stream that music as well.
Okay, but in terms of movies, can you only watch movies on your television through the iTV that you purchase from iTunes?
Yes, that is correct.
Okay. You know, I also read, and maybe I read on one of your web blogs, that Walmart is, maybe considering getting into this business as well. Is that true?
Yeah, and they are really nervous by what Apple is doing with their movie download service and have actually put a lot of pressure on the movie studios to not allow Apple to sell movie downloads for less money than than Walmart charges for DVDs.
How much are these movies to purchase a movie, and how much? And I think Amazon even has an option where you rent the movie file.
Yeah, so with Apple, it's usually between $9.99 and $14.99. So not a significant difference from a DVD. And you do lose some of the convenience and portability if you have the DVD. Again, you don't have to deal with.
Right.
You can download something instantaneously. You don't have to go to the store or whatever. So there's some trade-offs there. I think a lot of people feel like $14.99 is a little too much
mm-hmm.
for a movie download, especially when, let's face it, you can get a lot of this content for free over the
right.
internet if you apply yourself a little bit.
But am I correct that that takes a long time to download sometimes?
Not necessarily anymore. There's some new technologies like BitTorrent, which are making it easier and easier to get movies and really like large files really quickly.
And technically, this is illegal to do this, correct?
It is. It is illegal to do it, but it is a pretty widespread phenomenon. And I would say that a lot of just like with a lot of the music content,
right,
is being legally downloaded. The vast majority of films that are being downloaded over the internet
mm-hmm.
are illegal as well.
All right, now switching over to the iPod. Now Microsoft, which had incredible success in the video game arena with its Xbox, they're hoping to have that similar kind of success with its new portable MP3 media player. It's called Zune. iPod currently dominates this market. What do we know about Zune? When will it come out? How much is it going to cost?
Well, those are actually two of the biggest issues. The pricing and the release date are two of the things that Microsoft didn't discuss when it announced the Zune last week. But what we're looking at, we're expecting it to be somewhere around $300 for the 30-gig version of the device. And as far as the release date, we're not exactly sure, but it will be sometime in the next couple months.
I'm not sure with the Zune. Can you play movies on it?
Yes, it does have support for video, and actually will support a lot of the same video format files that the iPod does as well. So if you have unprotected content that you've downloaded for your iPod video, you can play that on your Zune as well. It is the first Zune device. Mm-hmm. It's really more music centric. At least that's how they're pitching it. And a lot of the most interesting features for it actually have to do with music, and it has actually built-in Wi-Fi. So you can share music with other people who have Zune players if they're within range.
Right, but they have some kind of weird limit on...
There are a lot of very frustrating restrictions on it. They basically have, if you give a song to another person
right.
over Wi-Fi, another person, someone else has a Zune, they can enjoy that song. They can only, there's a basically a limited time period
uh-huh.
and a limited number of plays before they have to purchase the song themselves. But the thing is, that applies not just to music that is purchased from the Zune
right.
store. That actually applies to anything in a collection. So let's say I have a song, I record my band, I put it on my Zune player,
right.
and I'm like, hey, I want to share it with my friends. Even that is encrypted and protected. So there's no way to over Wi-Fi just to share your own legal music.
Does the Zune have a built-in FM transmitter so you can play it on your car radio or something?
It doesn't have a built-in FM transmitter. It does have an FM tuner.
FM tuner. Oh,
yeah,
I see.
So you can listen to the radio, which is one of the things that Apple has long refused to put into the iPod.
Uh-huh. No, I understand. Now, one of the things, there's this big format war for the next generation of DVDs, but my understanding is that the video game wars are going to actually play a big role in maybe deciding which format takes hold. I don't know, maybe that's an overstatement, but can you explain this?
Yeah, so basically there are two major formats which are vying to be the successor to the DVD. And one is called HD DVD, and the other is called Blu-ray. And they're very, very similar in a lot of respects. Blu-ray has a little bit higher capacity, and there's some other technical differences between the two formats. But essentially what each gives you is the ability to watch a movie at home in high definition. And for a lot of people, that is something, if you're, looking for that great home theater experience, a lot of people just aren't satisfied with DVD. They really want the full high-definition experience, especially if they own a high-definition TV, right?
Right.
So what's happened is that, unlike last time with the DVD, there were two competing formats when the DVD was introduced 10 years ago, and we ended up having a compromise. This time around, there's been no compromise, and so the heavyweights in the industry have sort of lined up each one behind one format. So Sony's with Blu-ray, Toshiba's with HD DVD, and they're lining up manufacturers on each side. They're also working to line up the movie studios because they believe
mm-hmm.
that having the movie studios on their side releasing films in their format will help them dominate this next generation battle. And what's happened is that a lot of the studios have committed to releasing in both formats. And so what's going on now is that sort of the next phase of the battle has moved on to the next generation video game consoles. And so Sony, which is a big proponent of Blu-ray, has decided that they are going to make Blu-ray the centerpiece of their new PlayStation 3 console.
And then what about the Xbox 360? Does it take the other format?
So Microsoft decided that they would release the Xbox without a next generation drive, with just a regular DVD drive. And then earlier this year at CES in January, they announced that they will offer an HD DVD external drive as an add-on if you want to sort of add that functionality to your Xbox. But it won't be used for playing games. It'll actually just be used for watching movies.
So if the if Sony's PlayStation 3 really takes off, will that be a significant boost for the Blu-ray DVD format?
Well, I think that's what Sony is thinking, and that's certainly what they're hoping. But the issue is that insisting that they put Blu-ray into these consoles has done a few things. One, it has really drived up the cost a lot. Even the least expensive PlayStation 3 will be $500,
right.
which is $100 more than the most expensive Xbox 360, and certainly a lot more than and twice as much as the Nintendo Wii console, which is coming out around the same time, a couple days after. The other part about the PlayStation is that the new Blu-ray drives are actually very difficult to manufacture, and so there's actually a shortage of the blue laser diodes, which are needed to manufacture the Blu-ray drives. So that is causing basically a manufacturing shortage. So Sony is going to have a lot of trouble getting enough consoles into the market before Christmas, for the big holiday buying season, and even afterwards. They've had to cut back and delay the launch of the console in Europe. So it's definitely not really rolled out exactly the way that they had hoped, and I think that the PlayStation 3 will be less of a factor in securing Blu-ray's dominance than they might have hoped.
Fair enough. Speaking of very high prices, I understand that TiVo released its latest version of its PVR, this Series 3, and I guess reading from your PVR Wire blog, I understand that people were very excited about this TiVo 3 because people like TiVo's menu, but they're trying to sell it for $800. Why so high?
Well, I think that there are a lot of expensive components that go into a device like this. I do think that the $800 is a little high. I think it's higher than it should be, especially considering the price of earlier TiVos. And also that for $800, you can buy a PC, right?
Right.
And one that does a lot of the same things.
But one of the things, I don't quite understand how this is going to play out in the marketplace, $800 for this high-definition PVR from TiVo, while a lot of people can go to their cable or satellite provider, get a PVR, yeah, it's subsidized, but for essentially like $13 a month. And that records high definition.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's a big issue. And that's one of the things that TiVo has really been struggling with as a company, is that the cable companies have sort of commoditized digital video recording and putting it into their set-top boxes. And what TiVo is banking on is that the experience they provide is considerably better. And they add some other, you know, pretty cool interactive features that the cable companies aren't offering. And I can say, as someone who has the cable company's PVR, I can say that the TiVo experience is so much better that I'm probably going to end up switching to the new Series 3 as well. Just sort of feeling a little tentative about dropping $800 on it.
Yeah, exactly. We only have time for one more thing. But cell phones, I mean, the trend that I've seen is they keep getting smaller and smaller and smaller. Is that the trajectory? We're going to see smaller phones, or is there some new innovation that we're going to see soon?
Well, I think obviously phones are getting smaller and smaller and thinner, which I think is a good thing, because they're not sacrificing functionality when they're making things smaller. I mean, the new BlackBerry Pearl, for instance, has the same sort of email functionality that people love in a BlackBerry, but in a much smaller form factor. But I think the biggest shift that we're seeing right now is the rise of what's called 3G and these high-speed wireless networks. And we're seeing more and more devices that are compatible with these networks. And we're also seeing the carriers rolling out their networks nationwide. So Verizon, Sprint, Singular, they're all rolling out their networks. Verizon's a little bit ahead of the others. But having this high-speed connection allows you to do some things that you couldn't do with the phone before, in terms of, you know, whether it's streaming video or downloading music or even video calling is something that they've been doing in Europe for a while that we could be doing here.
Fair enough. Peter, well, we're out of time. We are coming up on our break. Peter Rojas is co-founder and editor-in-chief of Engadget. Thanks so much, Peter.
Thank you.
This is WHYY-FM in Philadelphia. I'm Alan Tu, in for Marty Moskowain. This is Radio Times, and we are still awaiting live coverage from National Public Radio of President Bush's address to the United Nations General Assembly. That is scheduled for 11:30. He's expected to talk at least 15, 20 minutes. Some of the things he's going to be talking about include outlining his vision for the Middle East. He's also going to be talking about Iraq and Afghanistan. So stay with us.
This is special coverage from NPR News. I'm Neil Conan. World leaders have gathered in New York for the annual meeting of the United Nations General Assembly, and President Bush is expected to speak to the gathering in a few minutes. The UN plays, or hopes to play, key roles in the crises in Darfur and in southern Lebanon, and there will be great attention this year on Iran. Earlier this summer, the Security Council passed a resolution demanding that Iran cease uranium enrichment by the end of August, a deadline that has passed. Iran insists its nuclear program is intended to produce nuclear energy, not atomic bombs, and says any negotiations would have to be held without preconditions. In interviews earlier today, Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice acknowledged that such talks are underway with the foreign policy chief of the European Union. She also said the United States would not join the discussions until Iran stops uranium enrichment, at least temporarily. And she added that the international community has what she described as a credibility issue. If Iran continues to defy the Security Council, she said sanctions will be on the table. We should note that thousands of demonstrators are outside the United Nations today to protest the war in Iraq. With me here in Studio 3A are NPR's Lauren Jenkins, senior foreign editor, and Ron Elving, our senior Washington editor. Also with us, Trita Parsi, president of the National Iranian American Council, a Middle East specialist who's writing a book due out next year called Treacherous Triangle, The Secret Dealings of Israel, Iran, and the United States. And welcome to you all. Good morning.
Thank you.
And
good
morning.
Let me begin with NPR senior Washington editor Ron Elving. What can you tell us about what the president intends to say today?
What we've been told, Neil, is that the president is going to talk about democracy, about the agenda of freedom, about the role that the United States can play in spreading democracy in the world, particularly in the region of the Middle East. And he's going to challenge the world leaders who are gathered in New York today, as well as the UN delegates, to play a role in the expansion of democracy, as he will describe. In other words, challenging them, if you will, to join with the United States in its export of democracy to the rest of the world.
And on Iran?
On Iran, he will, of course, repeat the American position and demand that they stop enrichment. He may not emphasize the temporarily part, but he will try to get them to meet the conditions that the United States has set for coming to the table on both sides. And on Iraq, I think he will probably say relatively little.
Mm-hmm. Lauren Jenkins, NPR senior foreign editor, let me ask you how those remarks are likely to play before this crowd of world leaders in New York.
Well, I think with a lot of skepticism. I think all of the issues that the president will bring up, they've heard before. There's great divisions in the world about the U.S. policy of promoting democracy and the way it has promoted it. You know, they've emphasized elections. I think he'll talk about elections in Afghanistan, Iraq, and Lebanon, and probably not about the Palestine Authority, which elected a government he didn't like and has tried to overthrow through sanctions and all that. I think the issue will be taken by a lot of people that elections do not necessarily a democracy make, and a lot more has to be done if one really wants to change the world and the way we're doing it, the way the U.S. is doing it with a really with military might first, mm-hmm. With a club first, and very few apples offered later.
Trita Parsi, let me ask you also, there will be tremendous interest not only in President Bush's address this morning, but in the address scheduled for this evening of Iranian President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad, who's just arrived yesterday, I guess, from Cuba in the meeting of the non-aligned. And you would think after the Security Council says you must stop uranium enrichment by the end of August or sanctions will be applied that he might find himself on the defensive. It doesn't seem that way.
Not at all. I think the Iranians are feeling very confident right now. We've started to see cracks in the alliance between the United States, Europe, and China and Russia. A lot of people expected China and Russia to be the biggest problems, but yesterday French President Jacques Chirac came out and also started arguing against sanctions. So it seemed like the sanctions move was quite premature. There wasn't enough strength behind it. There wasn't enough pressure to be able to make the Iranians yield. And according to a lot of people, not enough incentives to make the Iranians agree to such a compromise.
Mm-hmm. There was a meeting between the President of the United States and the President of France, Jacques Chirac, this morning. And interestingly, President Chirac said there could be no negotiations with Iran on that package of incentives that you talked about earlier, unless Iran stops uranium enrichment. But Lauren Jenkins, as Trita Parsi is saying, this doesn't seem to be a cut-and-dried case of, well, there's the deadline, sanctions must follow.
No, not at all. And I think what we're seeing is a compromise is in the works that talks might begin between Iran and the Europeans, in which case Iran would then, within those talks, perhaps suspend temporarily, at least, enrichment to allow the U.S. condition to enter the talks. That seems to be what the French are trying to maneuver.
Mm-hmm. And Ron Elving, let me ask you, the president is obviously speaking to the world today. This is the annual gathering of world leaders, but there are several audiences that he will be addressing.
Yes, this is the president's unique opportunity, really, to speak to the world, where all the media from around the globe are following this one particular event, and it's an opportunity thus to reach eyes and ears that would not necessarily follow every move our president makes. But I don't think that that's necessarily the opportunity that the president is, at least judging from what we've seen thus far, planning to seize upon. I think instead he's taking this as another opportunity to make his case for how he sees the Middle East to an essentially American audience.
Mm-hmm.
Like so much else of what's going on this fall, all of what the president is going to do today is designed with November 7th midterm elections very much uppermost in the mind. This president needs very much to hold on to his majorities, Republican Party majorities, in the House and Senate. And as far as I can see, most everything that goes on this fall is being designed and tailored to serve that end.
Mm-hmm. Trita Parsi, similarly, when President Ahmadinejad ascends the rostrum later tonight, what audience do you think he is going to be addressing?
I think he's actually going to look a little bit towards the American audience, far more than he has in the past. I think the Iranians are trying to reach out to the American public, give a different face to the nation, kind of send them the signal that Iran is ready for talks, but the Bush administration isn't. And that's why we have seen the Iranian president agree to a lot of interviews with Western journalists as of late.
Mm-hmm. We should note the president is expected to start speaking in a few minutes, but events are continuing around the world. In Bangkok, Thailand today, tanks are reported to be rolling into the capital surrounding government buildings, and the Associated Press reports that Thailand's Prime Minister Thaksin Shinawatra has called a state of emergency as rumors of a military coup are sweeping the city. Lauren Jenkins, the government there has been in some trouble of late.
Absolutely. For about the last year, the Prime Minister's had a hard time holding on to power. There have been demonstrations over months and months, periodically, huge demonstrations against him. He's had new elections that he managed to get through, but still the public is against him.
Mm-hmm.
And I think what we're hearing is probably the first moves of a coup.
Obviously, we will pay attention to that throughout the day here on NPR News, and stay tuned for developments as they occur. We should also note that the United Nations, that we talked about Darfur, about South Lebanon, but the United Nations is also trying to select a new Secretary General. Kofi Annan's second term expires at the end of this year. Various candidates have been offered by their member nations. You have to be nominated. There's an unwritten rule that permanent members of the Security Council, they will not be the next president of next Secretary General of the United Nations, and nevertheless, Lauren, the organization itself finds itself at a bit of a crossroads.
Well, it always is. It's an organization which has great ideals and never functions up to expectations, and you know it's a scene of great disputes. International disputes are played out there, and power is played out there. I think every time an election comes around for a new Secretary General, it's a time for all these vested interests and regional interests to try and get their person in.
Mm-hmm. There are also consistently demands for reforms of the Security Council. There are five permanent members, 10 not permanent members, and there's always demands that this should be expanded to include powers that have emerged since the end of the Second World War, like Japan, like India.
Yeah. And the most interesting one now pushing for expansion, first seat, is Venezuela. Mr. Chavez, the president of Venezuela, is seeking a permanent seat in an expanded Security Council, if that happens.
Mm. The president is expected to start speaking in just a few minutes. Speaking to the General Assembly now is the United Nations Secretary General, Kofi Annan. As we mentioned, this is the end of his second term. That expires at the end of December. And there are a couple of other people who are on the on the rostrum with him. The United Nations General Assembly, there is a chair that you will see this in the pictures in the newspapers tomorrow, where the next speaker will be seated and ushered onto the stage, and he'll then go to a lectern. Seated above him is a group of three officials, the Secretary General of the United Nations, of course, Kofi Annan, the President of the General Assembly, that's Sheikha Haya Rashed Al Khalifa of Bahrain, just the third woman ever to be President of the General Assembly, and the Undersecretary General for General Assembly and Conference Management, that's Jian Chen of China. So those are the images of the those are the people who will be seated above the President of the United States once this session gets underway. If you've never visited the General Assembly of the United Nations, it's, as you can imagine, a vast hall. It sort of looks like a bit like a Dave Brubeck album from the 1950s. Abstract expressionism, which was sort of the rage then, dominates the wall. A little Juan Miró might be the artist who might spring to mind if you looked for somebody who might be designing this. There are then rows upon rows upon rows of seats for the various delegations, each arranged alphabetically. Each seat rotates alphabetically each year, and so you're never in the same seat for the next General Assembly. There are, if memory serves, I think five seats for each delegation. Normally, it's the ambassador to the United Nations and one of his aides, and the rest of the seats tend to be fairly empty most of the time. Today and tomorrow, when the world leaders gather, those seats are really crowded. Everybody is there, including, we may see there's been an enormous interest in whether there would be contact on the margins, as they say, between the United States and Iran at a meeting like this. The American officials have said, no, there would not be. But on this one occasion, President Ahmadinejad and the President of the United States are going to be in the same room, though a very big room and so far away that they're not likely to come into one another. But Lauren Jenkins, one of the things that is always of interest is who else the president will be meeting with, at least formally, as he has these bilaterals, as they're known, today and tomorrow.
Well, indeed. Well, he'll certainly meet with everybody of any major nation. He's already, yesterday, he started having bilaterals with smaller nations. I think he had Honduras and El Salvador was occupying his day yesterday. Today, he's, you know, meeting with French President Chirac. He'll go right down the roster of all the important world leaders that we engage with.
And Ron Elving, is there any agenda in who gets to meet with the president?
Well, obviously, the agenda is primarily to meet with those people who can do the president some good in whatever he's trying to accomplish at a given moment, although to some degree there's also a protocol, and you want to meet with people that you haven't met with before and not seem to snub anyone. But it was interesting to see the videotape of the president's meeting with Jacques Chirac this morning. As Jacques Chirac continued to talk, President Bush was quite evident in his discomfort, even though he was awaiting the translation to know exactly what was being said in French. The president seemed to have a pretty good idea that it wasn't something he would enjoy hearing. And even though this was all couched in very diplomatic terms, the president was squirming and making facial expressions that were probably far more expressive than he or his diplomatic aides would have preferred.
Trita Parsi, this visit has also been an opportunity for diplomacy for the Iranian president, Mahmoud Ahmadinejad. His first stop was in Havana, Cuba, the site of this year's meeting of the non-aligned.
Absolutely. The Iranian strategy has been to try to isolate the United States, portray this conflict that is taking place right now as America driving it. It's not the international community that is opposing Iran. It's actually the United States and Israel that is doing so. And to some extent, they have been quite successful, because the statement that came out of the NA movement after their meeting in Havana was completely what the Iranians were asking for, an endorsement of the Iranian position. And that's 118 countries that came to Iran. Side.
Mm-hmm. Lauren Jenkins, there are those who speculate that the confrontation this past summer between Israel and Hezbollah in southern Lebanon and in northern Israel was in some respects a proxy war between the Iran and the United States, the Iranian allies, Hezbollah, American allies, Israel, that this was a potential front in any confrontation between the United States and Iran.
Well, that's true, but as you said, that's speculation so far. I mean, I don't think there's any real evidence that shows that Iran, per se, unleashed Hezbollah. It seems to be more something Hezbollah on its own decided to do, although it depends on Syrian and Iranian support. They do have their own independent agendas. But it was seen that way. I think the world saw, you know, the might of U.S. weaponry, certainly used by Israelis, demolish and go after a Muslim radical group, guerrilla group that's been very bothersome to Israel. But one saw the use of bombs and planes of the sort that might be used, some people say, if Iran doesn't agree to stop enriching uranium. There's a lot of talk about bombing raids either by Israel or even the United States as a last resort to stop Iran's nuclear developments.
And the United States continues to insist all options are on the table when it says that.
Yes, they do.
Ultimately,
yes, they
military
do,
action is, yep, is the last option. Though the president has said repeatedly he hopes to solve this by diplomatic means, and we'll find out what he has to say about that. The president was scheduled to start speaking to the General Assembly about 5 or 6 minutes ago. Anyone with familiarity with the United Nations, that they're a little bit late comes as no surprise. And Trita Parsi, I did want to ask you that as this audience listens to the speeches, there's one after another by various world leaders. In this world today, the Conference of the Non-Aligned, which, for example, just met in Havana, emerged from the Cold War, not aligned with either side. The Conference of the Non-Aligned now seems to have aligned itself against the United States.
Well, there is this sense amongst a lot of nations, particularly nations such as Iran, that is requesting a bigger role in political affairs, that the entire structure of the international order has become obsolete. It's based on the Cold War. The Security Council and the five permanent members that have veto rights have all been granted that because of the Cold War. And it's a new world now. And it's a world in which the United States is upholding the current order. So it's natural that the United States also becomes a target by those countries that want to see a different order, that wants to see a bigger and greater role for themselves. And as you mentioned, Venezuela is a country that actually is requesting a seat on the Security Council, the permanent seat.
So is Brazil a rather larger and economically more important nation to the south?
Absolutely. And there's a lot of nations out there today that have a tremendous amount of clout and economic power that are not on the seat, whereas there's many other states that have a questionable seat, mindful of the power and the influence that they actually have today in world affairs.
Mm-hmm. And Lauren Jenkins, every time there is a crisis, and we could look at the crisis in Darfur, for example, where tens of thousands at a minimum of people have been killed in the western part of Sudan, and the United Nations Security Council passed a resolution saying, look, the African Union troops who are there are inadequate. This should be transferred to become a United Nations peacekeeping role. It should be more robust. And it should be at the invitation of the Sudanese government. And people look at that and say, how can the United Nations stand by and watch this develop, watch these people being killed, and do nothing?
Well, that's the dilemma. That's the dilemma of a world organization that doesn't have world power. I mean, it's a debating society. As a group of a venue where nations can come together, try and formulate a consensus on acts to be done, but at the same time, by nature and by its own rules, it can't dictate what it's going to do in another person's country. I mean, you know, this is where it all boils down, that you can't just send a group of peacekeepers into a country without that country's government asking for them or acquiescing, at least.
And there is certainly the situation in southern Lebanon, where there is a called for a United Nations peacekeeping force to enforce some Security Council resolutions stemming from the conflict between Israel and Hezbollah, and finding those troops, arranging those troops, getting countries to donate those forces, arranging the logistics for those forces, all of this is taking a great deal of time.
Absolutely. But Lebanon's a great example of where the government itself asked and agreed to have the troops brought in to help separate the Hezbollah from Israel.
Mm-hmm. And we're told that Secretary General Annan is about to wrap up his remarks to the United Nations General Assembly, so we can expect President Bush to be speaking fairly soon. So stay with us if you've joined us to listen to this broadcast. And Ron Elving, as sequences of American presidents, American politicians have just been found enormous frustration sometimes with the United Nations structure, with its inability to act with any sort of dispatch or decision often.
You know, that really wasn't the experience of a period of time in which the United Nations was seen as being a great tool of American policy, more often than not. Right after World War II, and of course this was a World War II post-war creation, and then it did become, if you will, the official body of the Cold War, the official place in which the United States could try to advance its cause in the Cold War. We had the United Nations enter into the Korean War on the side that the Americans were fighting on, the South Korean side, in 1950, and we again had the United Nations imprimatur, if you will, after a very strong case had been made before the United Nations by our Ambassador Adlai Stevenson in the Cuban Missile Crisis of 1962. In both of those instances, separated by a dozen years perhaps, but those were the two most significant immediate post-war instances in which the United Nations played a tremendous role in support of American interests in the Cold War and in dealing with the Soviet Union, dealing with Communist China, a very aggressive military power at one time. And that was seen as being, if you will, the moral suasion that added to American firepower and that made the Cold War ultimately a war the United States could win. Mm.
That applause you heard behind us was for the conclusion of the speech by the Secretary General, who has left the lectern and assumed his seat at the top, that row of three officials we mentioned earlier. And we're about to be getting an introduction of the President of the United States. Again, the officials up there at the top of the rostrum at the United Nations General Assembly. I think we're listening now to Sheikha Hayat Rashid Al Khalifa of Bahrain, the President of the General Assembly. She'll be introducing the President.
The General Assembly starts its annual general debate. During the next 2 weeks, world leaders will address the most pressing issues and challenges facing their respective nations and peoples. We face a global change that, in its speed, scope, and scale, is unprecedented. We are all increasingly exposed to sharp social and economic inequalities that take on new dimensions. We live in a world afflicted by violent and armed conflicts, hunger, and disease, a world threatened by international terrorism, organized crime, and the proliferation of all types of weapons, a world brought closer together by the forces of globalization, yet divided by ethnic strife and a growing technological gap and mistrust, a world where the enjoyment of human rights is still an unrealized dream for millions of people. We, the international community, have a moral duty to reach collective solutions to resolve these mutual concerns. Excellencies, ladies and gentlemen, I welcome you all to this historic hall. All the heads of states who came to participate in the 61st session of the General Assembly. Your participation in the 61st session is an expression of your dedication and commitment to the United Nations and the spirit of multilateralism. Last year, at the 2005 World Summit, you reached a consensus on a wide range of far-reaching measures to enhance the collective response of the international community to the challenges of today's world. I would like to take this opportunity to congratulate my predecessor, His Excellency Mr. Yan.
And we're listening to remarks by the President of the 61st General Assembly, Sheikha Hayat Rashid Al Khalifa of Bahrain, as we continue with the formalities as the General Assembly session opens. And Lauren Jenkins, I did want to say we've been talking about some of the frustrations of U.S. officials. One of the things that they were concerned with was reform of the United Nations Human Rights Commission, and that was was one thing that was carried out earlier this year.
Yes, indeed. It was finally, after a lot of argument, it was carried out. Nations that shouldn't have been on it were sort of marginalized, and they did make a serious reform, although there's so many more that are before the agenda that will maybe never happen, because there are too many things that keep being brought up. How do you make an organization like this less unwieldy and more efficient?
And as we talked about proposals for reform for expanding membership in the Security Council, it might be more inclusive, more efficient, maybe not.
Well, the more people you get at a table with a veto, it might be more inefficient.
The Security Council, of course, is a separate organization from the General Assembly. The General Assembly, when you hear the United Nations often described as a talking shop, usually what they're talking about is the General Assembly, where speeches are made to largely empty crowds, with the exception of these 2 days of the year. There are considerably more interest in the meetings of the Security Council, which the presidency there rotates every month, so there is considerable interest as that organization continues to discuss. It does have authority under what's called Chapter 7, a rarely invoked chapter of the United Nations Charter, under which it can invoke military force. Chapter 7, of course, was invoked in the first Persian Gulf War when Iraq occupied the United Nations and Arab League member Kuwait.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, in a case like that, when there is agreement among all the members, they can invoke it. Again, there's still five nations have a veto power and can stop it. So there are limits on Chapter 7, too.
Trita Parsi, let me ask you, in the continuing confrontation with Iran and the United States, the Security Council agreed to pass this resolution, yet Iran seemed to be banking all along that its allies, China and Russia in particular, would not go along with sanctions.
True. And at the same time, I think part of the reason why the Iranians have been quite bold in defying the Security Council is because of the realities of power on the ground. I think the United States, the Bush administration, has been trying to negotiate from a position of imagined strength. That would be great if other people share that imagination, but it just isn't the case. The United States is moving forward, thinking that it's more powerful than it actually is, and the Iranians have, because of that, been able to see through several of the bluffs. And that's what we're seeing right now with the United States pulling together the allies, passing a resolution, and then it turns out that it simply didn't have much teeth.
There seems to be a little bit even more than that in terms of the Iranian position, a sense, if you will, that they believe history's on their side.
Absolutely. They have this belief that they are a rising state, that the United States' influence on the world scene is declining, and that sooner or later the United States would have to come to terms with the realities of Iran. This is something that is deeply ingrained in the leadership of the Iranian state right now.
And I think dissembling is not too strong a word to use in regards to its nuclear position. It's been confirmed that the Iranians admit that they hid their nuclear policies from the IAEA and what they were supposed to be reporting to the IAEA for many years. And they're dissembling on this question. Iran's questionable record on human rights, other issues, this is, from their point of view, besides the point.
Well, it's true. I'm sure they're happy that that's not being discussed right now, but it's also, from our end, we're deciding what to talk about. And the United States, the Bush administration, has focused almost entirely on the enrichment issue and on the nuclear issue, instead of also talking about many of the other problems that the Iranian state constitute to U.S. foreign policy in the region. And I think that's been to the detriment of the United States itself. It would actually have been better if they brought in human rights, if they brought in many of the other issues, instead of just focusing on enrichment. Because enrichment issue is something that the Iranian state has been able to use to its advantage within the domestic political context of Iran. The Iranian people, by and large, are completely in favor of Iran having a nuclear program. Not necessarily nuclear weapons, but a nuclear program. So when the West is challenging Iran on that issue, it only helps the Iranian government to bridge the gap between itself and the people of Iran.
It's seen as a nationalist issue.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. And Ron Elving, in previous years, in previous confrontations, the United States made great strides in its arguments with the world in this context, at the United Nations, for example, and the Soviet Union, on exactly that question, on the question of human rights and Helsinki.
This was one of the hallmarks of American policy throughout the Cold War period, say from the end of World War II until 1989-1990, that we could pose ourselves and the Western democracies as a far better place for people to live, a place to which people wanted to go, a place that the communist countries were walling off because it was too attractive to some of their citizens and residents. And this was a strong argument that carried over culturally as well as politically, a tremendous attraction to American and Western products and so forth. This is much more difficult to sustain in the current age, as there has been so much more cross-pollinization between these cultures, between these different kinds of forms of government, and there has been a great deal more sharing, if you will, positively and negatively, between the different parts of the world. It's much more difficult to just set up an easy us-against-them, a white-black, either-or set of choices than it might have been 30, 40 years ago. And to some degree, the Bush administration has devoted itself to re-establishing a white-black, either-or, us-against-them dynamic in the world through this war on terrorism. Now, of course, the problem is you don't want to define it as us-against-them, say, for example, Christians versus Muslims, as we've seen in recent days. It doesn't take much to set off to ignite extremely angry reactions any time that you divide the world along religious lines, any time that you make a remark such as the Pope made the other day that was seen as denigrating to the Prophet of Islam, and of course immediately there were reactions, violent reactions, demands for an apology. I think George Bush has experienced some of the same thing when he used the word crusade a few years ago. That was rapidly made clear to him to be verboten, to be a word that would set off the kind of negative reactions that would set back American policies and agenda.
That is Ron Elving, NPR's senior Washington editor. Also with me here in the studio is Lauren Jenkins, NPR's senior foreign editor. With us as well is Trita Parsi, who is president of the National Iranian American Council and author of the forthcoming book Treacherous Triangle, The Secret Dealings of Israel, Iran, and the United States. I'm Neil Conan. We're awaiting an address by President George W. Bush to the General Assembly of the United Nations. Things are running a little bit slower than we had anticipated. He was scheduled to start speaking at 11:30 this morning Eastern Time, and we've been listening to remarks by the President of the General Assembly, Sheikha Hayat Rashid Al Khalifa of Bahrain, and we are still waiting for the introduction of the first round of speeches, the round of speeches by the heads of state that are, the heads of government that are gathered in New York for the General Assembly. Of course, the President of the United States is both head of state and the head of government, but so we qualify on either count. But for the most part, it is prime ministers rather than kings who come to address the General Assembly, and for that matter, in states, for example, like Israel, it would be the prime minister, the head of government, as opposed to the head of state. Germany has this similar arrangement where the real power is within the prime minister's office and not the presidency. The General Assembly will listen to a sequence of speakers from all of the member states as they express their interest in addressing the world body. And obviously the issues are global. The issues are also local, as each of them has an opportunity to be seen as an international statesman addressing this august institution. At the same time, Lauren Jenkins, we've been hearing rumors all day about a potential military coup in Bangkok. It is not the first time, I don't believe, that somebody in the world has taken advantage of the absence of a leader at an international meeting to say, well, now might be the time.
That's always a favorite time to have stage a coup is when the government, the head of the government, is out of town.
So a state of emergency has been declared in Bangkok. There are reports of confirmed reports now of tanks rolling into the streets of the capital of Bangkok and taking up positions around government buildings. They are broadcasting pictures of the royal family in Bangkok. There was just a celebration there earlier this year of the anniversary, I think, of the longest ruling monarch in the world, and of course royal families from around the world sent their representatives to that to attend these various ceremonies. And this is an introduction to the first speaker, we're told now, to address the General Assembly is going to be President Lula da Silva of Brazil. So he will be speaking to the General Assembly before the President of the United States. Let's listen.
And gentlemen, heads of state and government, Ms. Sheikha Ahaya Al-Khalifa, Madam President of the 61st session of the UN General Assembly, Mr. Kofi Annan, Secretary General of the United Nations, ladies and gentlemen, members of the delegations. When I first took the floor from this rostrum in 2003, I stressed the need for urgent and relentless action to fight the scourge of hunger and poverty in the world. This is what we are doing in Brazil. We have combined economic stability with social inclusion policies. The standard of living of Brazilians has improved. Employment and income have grown. The purchasing power of the minimum wage has increased. Our resources are scarce. But even so, we have achieved surprising results. The family stipend at the core of our Zero Hunger program assures a basic income to over 11 million Brazilian families. Well-fed people can enhance their dignity, their health, and their learning capacity. Putting resources into social programs is not expenditure, it is investment. If with so little we have done so much in Brazil, imagine what could have been done on a global scale, if the fight against hunger and poverty were a real priority for the international community. Where there is hunger, there is no hope. There's only desolation and pain. Hunger nurtures violence and fanaticism. A world where people starve will never be safe. The sheer size of the task will not daunt us, especially if we are not alone. All here know that some 840 million human beings, nearly one out of seven in the planet, do not have enough to eat. 50 billion additional dollars each year are needed to reach the Millennium Development Goals on time. The international community can afford it. On the positive side, just think, for instance, of the hundreds of billions of dollars invested to move forward the full integration of Eastern European countries into the European Union. On the other hand, think of the cost of wars and other conflicts. All here know that the second Gulf War may also have cost hundreds of billions of dollars to date. With much less, we can change the sad reality of a large share of the world's population. We could alleviate the plight of these people.
Support for NPR podcasts comes from Acura, featuring the all-new turbocharged Acura RDX with available voice-activated navigation. More at acura.com/RDX.